The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. It appears I will be reading to you from two different issues of Time magazine. When I move to the second one, I will tell you so. It will be from August 8/August 15, 2022, entitled Into the Metaverse. In the one that I'll begin with, it's dated August 22/August 29, 2022. As usual, it is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. This particular edition features someone, it appears to be a female, with a big sun hat on an orange dot, poking her finger into a turquoise two-dimensional page with concentric white circles all around. How to do more good was the lead article for this particular magazine. I will begin with contents of this magazine dated August 22/August 29 with the brief. It's entitled A Climatic Change, by Justin Warland. Chuck Schumer is featured in the cover page of the article. It's a full page, but one sees him only his face and upper body in the lower right-hand corner, grinning, wearing his glasses halfway down his nose. He has short-cropped gray hair with a receding hairline, wearing a gray suit under which it appears to be a gray, almost a lavender gray, I would say, plaid shirt. He has a lapel pin featuring the U.S. flag. The Inflation Reduction Act is about to jumpstart U.S. climate policy and change the world. In July, a pair of senators gathered reporters in the U.S. Capitol to deliver a message to President Joe Biden. It is time to declare a climate emergency. It was, to be sure, something of a Hail Mary. The prospects of major climate legislation had dimmed, and the two Democrats were desperate, worried it could be years before Congress tackled climate change in a meaningful way. Am I concerned it will be a decade before we have a climate majority, said Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, alongside Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island? I am damned concerned. Less than 3 weeks later, Democratic senators walked off the Senate floor in celebration after passing the Inflation Reduction Act, the most significant climate legislation in U.S. history. Once the House of Representatives passes it, Biden will, with his signature, begin a new era of climate policy in America. Experts say the legislation will dramatically accelerate the decline in U.S. emissions, putting the country within reach of the Biden administration's goal of slashing emissions in half by 2030 compared with 2005 levels. That goal serves as a barometer of how much climate change generated pain and destruction the world can avoid, and sets a destination of sorts for all U.S. climate policy. The Inflation Reduction Act offers a framework for how the U.S. will tackle climate change in the 8 years until that deadline and beyond. It invests nearly $370 billion in energy and climate change programs, including enormous tax incentives to advance renewable energy and electric vehicles. The bill still leaves many details to be determined, and battle lines are already forming over the future of fossil fuel production and how to advance environmental justice. Regardless of how those battles play out, the bill will give the U.S. newfound credibility as a climate leader on the international stage and help convince other countries that the energy transition is irreversible. It is impossible to know exactly how well every climate provision of the Inflation Reduction Act will work, but what is clear is that once signed into law, it will jumpstart an economic transformation and rejigger international climate politics with ripple effects that will shape communities large and small and the way Americans live. The Inflation Reduction Act's approach to cutting U.S. emissions is the result of decades of trial and error. President Bill Clinton attempted to pass an energy tax but fell short. Climate advocates learned that upsetting big business could doom legislation. President Barack Obama supported congressional efforts to pass cap and trade legislation endorsed by big business. When the bill sputtered in the Senate after being passed by the House, climate advocates learned they would need to foster grassroots support to get legislation across the finish line. Both of these lessons, and many others, paved the way for the Inflation Reduction Act. It relies largely on carrots over sticks, incentivizing businesses to decarbonize rather than penalizing them for not doing so, and it promises to create jobs and investment in Americans' communities, spreading the immediate benefits to broad swaths of the voting public. At the core of the legislation are tax credits for companies that build wind and solar power, as well as a slew of other clean energy technologies. These credits, which last for 10 years, should catalyze the creation of a decarbonized energy system and serve as the driving force behind the bill's emissions reduction. Beyond that, a range of industries will be nudged to decarbonize. Airlines will get credit for buying lower carbon fuel. Industrial firms will receive financial incentives to capture and store carbon dioxide in their production process. This legislation truly is transformative, says Dan Lassoff, a director at the World Resources Institute. It gives long-term investment certainty, which will really mobilize capital and transform our energy system. This may sound distant and wonky, but these changes will ripple across the economy and into your backyard. Nascent technologies from battery storage to hydrogen power will get a boost, creating new jobs and inspiring new companies. The legislation gives the Department of Energy new authority to lend private companies up to $290 billion to advance clean energy programs. Tesla received a loan from that same program a decade ago, helping it expand its manufacturing. The next clean technology giant could benefit from a similar loan. If not other provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act, you will notice the bill's effects as a consumer, too. Tax incentives for home renovations will create new opportunities for Americans to make their homes more energy efficient, with up to $14,000 in rebates for products like heat pumps, which provide a cleaner way of heating and cooling homes and electric stoves. Analysts say efficiency, combined with the lower cost of renewable power, will reduce consumer energy prices. And then there are the incentives for electric vehicles. Buyers can receive a tax credit of up to $7,500 per vehicle. Many consumers who are not even currently thinking of buying an electric car may soon find themselves in the market for one. This is the package we've been waiting for, says Leah Stokes, professor of environmental politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who has been a key advocate for robust climate policy. This is a transformative bill. Democrats and climate activists did not get every provision they wanted in the bill, and they had to strike compromises to keep their caucus together. The legislation incentivizes deploying carbon capture technology, which would allow a continued reliance on fossil fuels so long as companies capture the carbon emissions. Environmental justice activists argue these technologies will do little to help the underserved communities that tend to bear the brunt of environmental pollution from fossil fuels. And in what climate advocates call a poison pill, the legislation requires the federal government to auction some federal land for oil and gas drilling. How much of that land is actually developed will depend on a variety of factors, from fuel prices to activist pushback. The Inflation Reduction Act may help the U.S. confidently say the energy transition is in full swing, but more work remains to ensure the transition is swift and just. Still, with this act, we are entering a new era in the fight against climate change. There's a photo here. It's quite small, maybe a quarter of a page, and it's really in shades of white to sky blue to gray to tan. It's wind turbines in Palm Springs, California. The turbines themselves are gigantically tall, with the propeller blades almost as gigantic, about half the length. Each blade is about half the length of the pole that supports it, which towers far above the people looking at it. A bunch of people are standing around in hard hats, white helmets, and they're standing on sandy-looking soil. It looks sandy to me, anyway. And it's a pale, pale tan to beige to white. In the background, it looks hazy or foggy or smoggy. I do believe there is a range of mountains or hills way beyond the wind turbines, but those, they're shrouded. They're just shrouded in either a cloud or fog or something, smog maybe. But it appears to be a sunny day where the white-helmeted people are standing. What's interesting to me, in addition to the people, the wind turbines, and the background of lower hills or roundish mountains, is a big bus. Politics: Biden's bland leadership may be getting results. And this is by Brian Bennett. Joe Biden seemed caught off guard. An aide had interrupted the president's meeting with his economic team and a handful of CEOs on a stage in the basement of the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, July 28, to hand him a note. "You're trying to tell me something, huh?" Biden said. The message informed Biden that the bill to boost semiconductor chip manufacturing in the U.S. had passed the House. News that brought a wide grin as his staff in the room applauded. "Been trying a long time," Biden said. The president may indeed be starting to catch a few breaks. Just the week before, Biden had contracted COVID-19, and key planks of his campaign agenda appeared dead in the water. But Biden recovered quickly from the virus, thanks to protection from vaccine boosters and widely available antiviral medication. And now, after months of dismal approval ratings and being blamed for the worst inflation in decades, he's poised to sign a raft of significant legislation that delivers on a sizable chunk of what he promised voters. The CHIPS and Science Act will pump more than $52 billion into U.S.-based computer chip makers, create billions in tax credits to encourage more investment in the American chip industry, and pour tens of billions of dollars into cutting-edge scientific research. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats passed a sweeping bill that includes massive investments in reducing carbon emissions and lowering prescription drug costs. The Inflation Reduction Act would also set a 15% minimum on corporate tax rates for the largest corporations. It is now on track to pass the House and head to Biden, who has said he will sign it. If that bill is enacted, it will join the CHIPS bill and Biden's success in June, ushering through the first gun safety legislation in decades and the $1 trillion infrastructure package he signed into law in November. There was clearly a commitment and a desire on the part of everybody in the Democratic Party, Joe Manchin, thank God, included, in trying to get as much of the big agenda items done before November, says Ashley Etienne, a former communications director for Vice President Kamala Harris. It is unclear if those legislative accomplishments would be enough to reverse the decline in Biden's poll numbers, which continue to hover around 40%. Young voters in particular have soured on him. An average of polls published by 538 found Biden's approval among 18 to 29-year-olds has sunk to 37% from over 55% when he took office. Even the passage of the climate and tax bill may not be enough to help Democrats in the midterm elections in November. Concerns about the economy loom large, despite the latest jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showing 528,000 new jobs added in July, bringing the unemployment rate to 3.5%, the lowest in five decades. While the job market and consumer spending remain strong, the U.S. economy has contracted over the past 6 months, and any economic impact from that bill and the CHIPS bill would take years to be fully felt. The Inflation Reduction Act falls short of the ambitious policy proposals Biden laid out during the campaign and when he rolled out his wish list last year for the Build Back Better plan. Big portions of Biden's agenda are all but dead for the foreseeable future. No measure with a pathway to passing touches on his campaign promises to make community college free, invest in elder care and housing programs, or develop guaranteed paid leave programs for those caring for loved ones. Biden has been criticized from the left wing of his party for not pushing Congress harder and not taking more forceful executive actions on immigration, student loan debt forgiveness, and protection for access to abortions in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade. The Sunrise Movement, one of the most outspoken climate activist groups, is pushing for the climate and tax deal to pass, while stressing the ways they believe it falls short. Let us be clear, this bill is not the Green New Deal. It is not even at POTUS's Build Back Better. This is the Manchin Climate Plan, the group tweeted in late July. It is up to Democrats and Biden to tell Americans what they have accomplished, Etienne says, and the major promises Biden hasn't been able to land. We make the argument we've made great progress, and in order to complete the task or continue even further on these big-ticket items, you need more Democrats, she says. Biden's persistent and understated navigation around the far-left voices in his party may be what voters wanted when they elected him, says Timothy Naftali, a historian at New York University. People have been quick to describe his presidency as a flop and as unsuccessful, but each time he chooses that middle lane, it yields results, Naftali said. That bland leadership has been frustrating for many Americans, but after the tumultuous Trump era, Biden is delivering cool, calm leadership, likely too bland for young activists, but perhaps it's what the country needed, Naftali said. The passage of these bills would allow Democrats to flip the script going into the fall, says a Democratic House aide. This is not a referendum on Joe Biden. This is about what we have done and what we are trying to do versus what we know Republicans have as their goals, the aide says. Democrats will say they took steps to reduce inflation after having stimulated a struggling economy, overhauled the transit system, helped get much of the country vaccinated, and taken other bold steps to help end the pandemic. They will paint Republicans as seeking control of Congress to give tax breaks to corporations, launch investigations into Hunter Biden, and further restrict access to abortion. Congressional Republicans are portraying Democrats as soft on crime and indifferent to inflation, particularly high gas prices, which Republicans want to address by expanding oil drilling. The top Republican in the House, Kevin McCarthy, said July 26 at a conference hosted by the Trump-aligned America First Policy Institute that he planned to unveil a seven-point plan in September called the Commitment to America. Should they take control of the House next year, Republicans will hold hearings to rein in Biden's cabinet secretaries, McCarthy said, as well as push for increased police funding, demand harsher border security policies, vote to pass a parents' bill of rights in determining what is taught in schools, and create a House committee on China that works to reduce U.S. dependence on Chinese production of precious metals and medicine. During his meeting with CEOs, Biden grinned as his taciturn Treasury Secretary, former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, reported that despite the country's gross domestic product shrinking for a second quarter, the economy is still adding jobs, American household finances are holding up, and consumers are spending money. With skill and luck, it will be possible to maintain that strength, Yellen said. That prompted Biden to tell a family story. It never takes much. He recalled how his grandfather, a college football star who played for Santa Clara College in California in the early 1900s, liked to say that having lady luck on your team was not enough. A team also needed skill on the bench. We are looking for both, Biden said. Voters in November will decide if Biden and the Democrats have enough of either. Here's a small photograph with President Biden seated at a small table. He's signing a bill to boost U.S. semiconductor production, August 9. I'm sure that means August 9 is the date the bill was signed. And he's wearing a rather bright blue, like a royal blue, a suit, white shirt, and blue patterned, I'm not sure what the pattern is, blue patterned tie. He's apparently outdoors because his white hair is quite gleaming, gleamingly white, and he is wearing sunglasses. Time off. Reality TV has shaped our world. By Judy Berman. I'm not here to make friends, I'm here to win. So goes the ultimate reality TV cliche, one popularized by the first season of Survivor, which got viewers hooked on competitions between real people, cashing in on the 15 minutes of fame that are the birthright of all Americans. 2 decades later, the declaration has proved true of the genre itself. Critics, social scientists, even fans keep unearthing revelations about reality TV's crass manipulations and toxic tropes. Yet the genre has conquered culture and claimed its prize, our attention. Reality TV has radically altered the landscapes of celebrity, politics, and power. Its stars have penetrated every corner of the entertainment industry, from Harry Styles and Cardi B on the pop charts to Laverne Cox and Emma Stone in Hollywood. Without docu-soaps, gossip rags would be virtually blank. and it has made many people very rich. Kim Kardashian has a net worth of $1.8 billion. To state the obvious, reality TV also catalyzed the rise of our 45th president. In a 2016 interview that critic James Poniewozik highlights in Audience of One, Trump Television and the Fracturing of America, a former supervising editor of The Apprentice explained the show's aim, make Trump look good, make him look wealthy, legitimate. Well, it worked, and Trump brought the medium's guiding principles, conflict, chaos, public humiliation, to the West Wing. He was hardly the first to politicize the genre. By the 90s, reality TV was confronting third rail issues like racism, LGBTQ rights, abortion, and AIDS. And that was just in early seasons of MTV's The Real World. Young people have grown up expecting to see their values represented on shows as bland as Dancing with the Stars, which faced an outcry when Sean Spicer tried to launder his image as a contestant. In other words, reality TV's winning streak is not necessarily good for society. To the extent that the U.S. has become a harsher, angrier, more divided place in the 21st century, reality TV, which regularly rewards people for their cruelty, belligerence, and superficiality, bears some of the blame. As sociologist Danielle J. Lindemann notes in her recent book, True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us, for all its extreme personalities and outlandish premises, reality TV reflects how regressive we truly are. With that in mind, our list of reality TV's most influential seasons is not a celebration of every show or of the genre writ large. It is a measure of the profound impact its charming hams, its malignant narcissists, and the bizarre situations they inhabit have had on our world, for better or worse. Actually, that says for better and worse. Although the term reality TV came decades later, examples of the genre emerged in tandem with the advent of television. Candid Camera first placed unwitting people in absurd situations and recorded their reactions in 1948. Through storylines about gay identity and divorce, PBS's culture-shaking 1973 docuseries, An American Family, made the personal political. The 80s police ride-along cops and the pay-in to ostentatious wealth, that was lifestyles of the rich and famous, epitomized the tough-on-crime, greed is good, the zeitgeist of the Reagan years, and helped cement the genre's implicit conservatism. The dominant format as we know it today, a composite of fly-on-the-wall scenes and cast members' solo interviews with producers, edited to create a coherent narrative with clearly defined characters, coalesced in 1992 with The Real World. The show's first season finale found the Gen X cast breaking into the production room set up in their loft and realizing they were not documentary subjects so much as characters in an unscripted soap opera. Such deceptions would come to look quaint once a second wave of docu-soaps like Bravo's Real Housewives surfaced in the mid-aughts. The producers of those cable franchises had likely been emboldened by the reality revolution that remade broadcast TV around Y2K. A cohort of popular and, thanks to product placement and low production costs, lucrative competition series edged out scripted programming. So tenacious is the genre, many of these shows are still airing, from Big Brother to The Bachelor. Cable has its own enduring reality contest, too. Bravo has Project Runway and Top Chef. RuPaul's Drag Race leveled up from Logo to VH1. MTV's The Challenge dates back to 1998. And CBS has now adapted its format for the challenge, USA. In the late 2000s and early 2010s, amid a renaissance in scripted programming on cable, it looked as though the ascendance of paid platforms might lead to reality TV's extinction. Instead, streaming has intensified the race to create cheap, addictive, populist content. As part of its potentially quixotic effort to become a standalone cable substitute, Netflix has built a global reality arsenal that ranges from sugary import, The Great British Bake Off, to diabolical dating experiment, Too Hot to Handle. Rival streamers have followed suit after 20 seasons on E! The Kardashian-Jenners now license their domestic lives to Hulu. Between the imminence of streamers' contraction and the increasing demand for cheap time fillers from linear networks hobbled by streaming, reality TV has a stronger financial foundation than ever. Once dismissed as a noxious fad, reality TV has hardened into an institution. When social scientists study the effects of this entrenchment, their conclusions are rarely encouraging. Reality shows have been found to exacerbate body anxiety, increase physical aggression, and mess with our ideas about romance. It would be alarmist to suggest watching 90 Day Fiancé every once in a while is likely to warp our brains, but long-term exposure to dozens of shows that reinforce the same misperceptions is different. As media critic Jennifer L. Posner notes in her 2010 book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, reality programming has the power to influence our notions of normalcy versus difference and to encourage generalizations about different identities. Since Posner published her book and earnest critiques of reality TV became old news, a knowing acceptance of the genre's deceptions has set in, and cheerful self-parodies like HBO Max's F-Boy Island have emerged. There's plenty to enjoy about reality TV, and let me be clear, I do enjoy it, says Judy Berman. Who could deny a person living in the maelstrom of 2022 the mindless pleasure of Love Island? The genre is not monolithic either. Along with talent contests, superstars, unscripted programs are often the first to bring poorly understood communities to the small screen. Sometimes it even gives those subjects the respect they deserve. But taking reality TV seriously means holding it accountable for its frequent awfulness. Shows are still edited to reinforce stereotypes, from the vapid blonde to the angry black person. DocuSoaps thrive on the notion that women are petty gossips. Dating shows traffic in gender essentialism, and those with LGBTQ casts remain scarce. People with disabilities are treated like freak show fodder. Asian and Latinx Americans remain underrepresented. Recent attempts to compensate for this erasure, like Indian matchmaking, have arguably hurt as much as they have helped. You cannot even watch The Masked Singer without worrying about humming along with an insurrection enabler. Unless you're fully off the grid, there is no isolating yourself from these shows' influence. I would not count on young people who pore over YouTube and TikTok to bring about their obsolescence either. Our current influencer economy might be based in social media, but it is an extension of the original famous for being famous model of reality TV. TikTok's D'Amelio sisters now have their own Hulu series, and no other American has more Instagram followers than Kylie Jenner. If we cannot stop this pop culture juggernaut, and wouldn't want to, then we have got to understand what its most indelible storylines are communicating to us about who we should be, what we should believe, and once in a while, who will best embody our values in a political forum. Because reality TV may not be here to stay, may not be here to make friends, but it is most definitely here to stay. Again, that was by Judy Berman. And there are some reality TV shows listed. Time has listed the 50 most influential reality TV series, seasons of all time. I'm only going to read the titles of 8. Candid Camera, 1949. What began as a radio program called Candid Microphone soon pioneered the winning formula of hidden camera prank shows. Candid Camera introduced the juxtaposition of a manipulated environment and authentic human reaction that would later be exemplified in Punk'd and international shows like Old Enough. An American Family, 1973. Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, 1984. The Real World, 1994. Cops, 1994 to 1995. Survivor, 2000. Making the Band, 2000. And Big Brother, 2001. I'm going to read the little detail for Making the Band of 2000. The singing competition has become a reality staple and the launchpad for many a pop star's career. While the average viewer may associate this model with American Idol, it was actually predated in the U.S. by Making the Band, which debuted in 2000 at the height of the boy band craze and produced the platinum-selling quartet O-Town in its first season. The View in War, The EU Finds Unity by Bruno Macias. This is under the headline World. In recent years, the identity of the European Union has come to be inextricably linked with the logic of crisis. The EU does not just face crises, it seems to be defined by them. In a way, it welcomes crises. It has turned danger into opportunity, with many of its defenders arguing that crises can be a way to move forward. Everything has been postponed for the moment when the EU would face a larger crisis. This is a long article. It may well be abridged. No, it's not. It's a short article. There's another longer one following it. This is the View opener, again by Bruno Macias, formerly Portugal's Secretary of State for European Affairs, is the author of Geopolitics for the End Time. A larger crisis would force the EU either to finally take a decisive step toward a more perfect union or to enter a state of terminal decline. Over the past few years, many have speculated about the specific form this larger crisis would take. It seemed to me obvious it would be a geopolitical crisis in some sense, because it was from the external environment that the sort of challenges the EU remains unprepared for could more clearly arise. Challenges demanding a quick response or requiring a level of improvisation or adaptation. The war in Ukraine was the larger crisis. It was an interesting moment of introspection and doubt in a second sense. Suddenly, we were no longer sure the problem was with the EU. Was it the EU that created the dangerous dependence on Russian energy that now threatens to upend the European economy as a whole? Actually, no. It was mostly the German political and economic elites that ended up captured by the mirage of cheap Russian energy. The EU struggled unsuccessfully against the dominance of these elites. But it never made any secret what a bad idea it thought Nord Stream really was. Nor was it ever enamored with the French concept of a larger Europe, including Russia. if only because the Kremlin despises the EU and wants to see it fail. Consciences are slowly changing. In a recent trip to Prague, I expected to find the usual skepticism about Brussels and supranatural power. It was still present in some form, but most of my interlocutors were much angrier and much more suspicious about German and French power. With the center of political action now decisively geopolitical rather than cultural, Czech elites suddenly find themselves closer to Brussels than to Berlin. At least in Brussels, one can discuss how to respond to the Russian threat. The EU thinks about the world in terms of large blocks, that's B-L-O-C-S. Germany's concerned with parochial economic interests, while France still dreams about French power and prestige. Above the anxieties of the present moment, new vistas are opening up. A political union in Europe was never going to be built on economic foundations. Europe will come together as a geopolitical union or not come together at all. And now, for the first time, geopolitics is taking over. Already in the decision to grant Moldova and Ukraine candidate status, a quantum leap took place. No one spent much time discussing whether Ukraine enjoys the economic conditions necessary to join the EU. Under the circumstances, it would have been a ludicrous consideration. Instead, we assumed those conditions can be created in the future, provided Europe is able to ensure its own security. Relations between Brussels and Poland have improved. There are issues to solve, but both sides agree on the fundamental question of what our enemies are. With Hungary, there's no such agreement, and in fact, the Hungarian government is now entirely isolated in Europe, seen by almost everyone as a Kremlin stooge. The war has taught us to focus on the essentials. The most difficult problem still to be solved is how to create in Brussels a common power that can be genuinely independent from French and German interests. The lack of such a power was responsible for Brexit, with Britain having concluded that inside the EU it would remain dependent on its old European rivals in Paris and Berlin. In the longer term, enlargement should be able to take us there. With Ukraine as a member, the simple combination of Polish and Ukrainian votes will exceed the German share. Have no illusions. This is the reason both France and Germany are looking for a solution to postpone Ukrainian membership. In the shorter term, we need new alliances between the South, Scandinavia, and Central Europe. But the balance of power is already shifting. You could see that in the recent proposal by the European Commission for an emergency power to declare a general union alert and mandate that every member state shall reduce its national gas consumption. Germany not only accepted that this will become a European competence under threat from a sudden energy collapse, it requested it. German vulnerability is a ray of hope for a future political union. All right, this is the article that's lengthier and maybe abridged. Under the heading Nation, the Great Reading Rethink. Proficiency rates in the U.S. are abysmal. Inside the effort to change the way kids are taught, by Belinda Luscombe. As a teacher in Oakland, California, Kareem Weaver helped struggling fourth and fifth grade kids learn to read by using a very structured, phonics-based reading curriculum called Open Court. It worked for the students, but not so much for the teachers. For 7 years in a row, Oakland was the fastest gaining urban district in California for reading, recalls Weaver, and we hated it. The teachers felt like curriculum robots and pushed back. This seems dehumanizing. This is colonizing. This is the man telling us what to do, says Weaver, describing their approach and the response. So we fought tooth and nail as a teacher group to throw that out. It was replaced in 2015 by a curriculum that emphasized rich literary experiences. Those who wanted to fight for social justice, they figured that this new progressive way of teaching reading was the way, he says. Now Weaver is heading up a campaign to get his old school district to reinstate many of the methods that teachers resisted so strongly. Specifically, systematic and consistent instruction in phonemic awareness and phonics. In Oakland, when you have 19% of black kids reading, that cannot be maintained in the society, says Weaver, who received an early and vivid lesson in the value of literacy in 1984 after his cousin got out of prison and told him the other inmates stopped harassing him when they realized he could read their mail to them. It has been an unmitigated disaster. In January 2021, the local branch of the NAACP filed an administrative petition with the Oakland Unified School District, OUSD, to ask it to include explicit instruction for phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension in its curriculum. Weaver and his co-petitioners, including civil rights, educational, and literacy groups, want schools to spend more time in the youngest grades, teaching the sounds that make up words and the letters that represent those sounds. His petition is part of an enormous rethink of reading instruction that is sweeping the U.S. So far this year, 5 states have passed laws that require training for teachers in phonics-based reading techniques, adding to the 13 that passed such laws last year. And in May, New York City Mayor Eric Adams announced elementary schools in the biggest district in the country would be required to adopt a phonics-based reading program. The timing for such a dramatic change feels especially challenging. Elementary school teachers are already having to recalibrate after 2 years of disruption, vicious fighting about public health mandates as well as what kids should be taught about race and gender, and a widespread parental freak out about how little their children have learned during the pandemic. Now the most fundamental skill that society asks them to pass along is also being completely shaken up. But advocates say it cannot wait. In 2019, even before the pandemic upended instruction, only 35% of fourth graders met the standards for reading proficiency set by the National Assessment of Educational Progress, an even lower number than in 2017. Only 21% of low-income students measured by whether they qualify for free lunch, 18% of black students, and 23% of Hispanic students can be considered on track for reading by fourth grade. These numbers have been low for decades, but the pandemic has given the dismal results extra urgency. There have been choices made where our children were not in the center, says Weaver. We abandoned what worked because we did not like how it felt to us as adults, when actually the social justice thing to do is to teach them explicitly how to read. While reading is a foundational skill, it is not a natural one. Given enough time around other humans, the vast majority of youngsters will learn to walk upright and talk. For most children, however, recognizing that certain squiggles on a page or screen correspond to certain sounds requires painstaking instruction. In all, the 26 letters of the English alphabet can be combined to make about 44 sounds, depending on your accent. When those sounds are put together, they create 15,000 syllables, and untold numbers of words. Ideally, children figure out what the letter string says at about the same moment a word they already know crystallizes into view. And after a couple of those aha moments, usually starting in first and second grade, when Nikki reveals itself as nice, or calf transforms into chief, the word seems to move into permanent memory. This is known as the simple view of reading. It is the product of a robust ability to decode letters and a strong vocabulary. There are many schools of thought on how best to aid this process, but the main contretemps has been about whether kids need to be taught how to sound out words explicitly, or whether, if you give them enough examples and time, they will figure out the patterns. The latter theory, sometimes known as whole language, says teaching phonics is boring and repetitive, and a large percentage of English words diverge from the rules. Hello there, though, thought, through, and tough. But if you immerse children in beautiful stories, they will be motivated to crack the code, to recognize each word. The counter argument is that reading is as connected to hearing as it is to sight. It begins, phonics advocates say, with speech. This understanding and the data that support it has become known as the science of reading. This debate was supposedly settled in 2000 when the National Reading Panel, a big group of literacy experts that examined hundreds of studies on what instruction kids need to read, released a report. It recommended explicit instruction in the things Weaver's petition asks for: phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. This was a victory for the phonics camps. But it is one thing to declare a war is over and another to parcel out territory. Thus was born the notion of balanced literacy, which was an attempt to correct the ship's course rather than turn it around completely. Schools would introduce more instruction in the link between sounds and letters, but that could be sprinkled in with other methods teachers thought worked, like prompting kids to use context clues, including, say, pictures, when they came to a word they did not know. The net result, says Timothy Shanahan, a former director of reading for Chicago schools and an early literacy expert who was on the panel, was that balanced literacy came to mean whatever anybody wanted it to. Schools did not have to buy expensive new curriculums. Districts did not have to retrain their teachers. Teachers could add some lessons on phonics, but they did not have to hit reset on the way they taught. A 2019 survey of more than 600 elementary school teachers by Education Week found that more than two-thirds used a balanced literacy philosophy, although most also said they incorporated a lot of phonics. The idea was each group would get some of what they wanted, says Shanahan. I have got to admit, I always thought that was a bad idea. It seemed to me you should just go with the research. Reading scores did not improve much after balanced literacy was introduced, but they did not plummet either. Things might have stumbled along in much the same way, except that education departments around the country had begun to earn the ire of a particularly determined group, the parents of dyslexic children. People with dyslexia take much longer to sort out the connection between sound and symbol. The immersion method of teaching was simply not going to work for them. Pressure from these parents, plus some crusading journalism, a steady stream of research, impressive results from several school districts, and heightened concern about pandemic learning loss have finally turned the tide back toward a stronger emphasis on phonics. dyslexia is not linked to intelligence. It has been described as an island of weakness surrounded by a sea of strength. It has no cure, but can be overcome. So when some wealthy, well-educated parents found their otherwise typical children were not learning to read, they had questions for the school. These were met in many cases with the advice to read to them more. The parents then did what educated, wealthy people do when they feel slighted. They looked at the research, paid for expensive testing, called their representatives, and contacted their friends in the press. What they found was the methods many teachers were using were not supported by the data. They were supported by theories, observations, hopes, and some would argue a few guru-like figures. Just as most children, no matter how many times they've been in a car, still need to be taught to drive, most readers benefit from being explicitly taught how sounds and letters go together. This is true not just for dyslexics, who represent about 10% of all learners, but for the majority of readers. I'm skipping ahead now to the past, to the last paragraph. Teachers have every reason to feel sore about the training they did not receive and the children they therefore could not help, but they don't have time to look back. Here's the lament, says Weaver, who's still in discussions with OUSD. The lament is that when we started using new materials, the kids were not learning how to read. And to explain that, rather than looking at our materials and what we were doing, we focused on the kids and said, something's wrong with them, something's wrong with our community. They are too traumatized or too broken. Their families are not good enough. They're poor. We explain the lack of learning in those terms as opposed to saying, wait a second, what are we doing? And what did we do when things were working? The last article was slightly abbreviated because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.